At least 35 people have been killed in the worst unrest in Iran for years. Protests have spread throughout the country after 22-year-old Mahsa Amini was arrested by Iran's morality police for allegedly breaking Head Start rules. Mahsa Amini eventually died whilst in police custody, and her death has resulted in a series of large-scale protests across the country, and it's now garnered significant international attention, including a statement from the UN. As the protests have grown, the regime has responded with water cannons, shooting, and now restrictions to social media. The clerical regime has been in power now for over four decades and it's constantly faced uprisings as it's tried to maintain its grip on power. So are we seeing the end of the clerical regime, or will this just be another footnote in Iran's long history? To discuss this all, I've got with me Dr. Mohammad Khan from the Rasana International Institute for Iranian Studies, which is a think tank based in Riyadh. How are you doing, Mohammad?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Thank you. What about yourself?
I'm good. It's good to have you here. So I think let's jump straight in. I think probably the best place to start, Mohammad, is what do we actually know what's taking place? What do we know definitely has taken place in terms of the circumstances around the arrest of this young girl and what seems to have transpired?
Right, okay. This incident, the killing of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Kurdish woman from the Kurdistan province, it happened within the city of Sadakez, which is a city within the Kurdistan province. She was arrested by the morality police, which is in Iranian known as Gasht-e Irshad, meaning the patrol of guidance, because her hair was showing, so the hijab was not fully covering her hair. So she was taken to a police station and she was beaten and tortured and she died. The narrative initially was it was a natural cause, a heart attack, but the family said because of the marks on the body. And a number of eyewitnesses also said, look, she had been tortured in the police station by the morality police. Death sparked a number of protests that have spread from the Kurdistan province to other provinces and to Tehran as well, right? So, but the background is that there's been an anti-hijab movement that over the last maybe 1 year or so. And you have many incidences where women have been arrested and detained and beaten and tortured by similar police or similar organizations that are affiliated with the clerical regime or with the Iranian regime. And this has led to a lot of resentment within society amongst the women. And they've reacted and started an anti-hijab movement where you'll have women removing their hijab and making TikTok videos and airing their removal of the hijab on other social media platforms and so on and so forth. And this has kind of led to more tensions with the regime because the regime sees the hijab as an important pillar of its ideology and a pillar of the Iranian revolution. So it's led to a kind of standoff over the last year, especially so since the president took power, Ibrahim Raisi, who's affiliated with the hardliners or the conservative element of the regime. So you had this kind of standoff now, and the protests have killed, as you mentioned, 35 people. That's what we know from the government and from media reports. But independent observers are saying it's probably double that, triple that, because you had live fire being used, and also there's possibly hundreds who have been injured in the aftermath of the killing of this girl. So that's the kind of brief synopsis of what's kind of playing out at the moment.
Where does the morality police fit into the broader Iranian system? And maybe for our listeners, if you could outline the clerical system, how it actually works, what are its main pillars, and where do the morality police fit into this? Because, I'm in the UK, I live in the West, so this is quite, it's a shock to hear that there is even a concept of morality police in the country.
Right, okay. The morality police, it's been there since the revolution in 1979. The revolution led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. So it's always been one of the pillars of the regime among many other pillars, but its role over the years has expanded depending upon who's been in power. As Ahmadinejad in power, you saw more power, more authority to the morality police. When Khatami was in power in the 90s, who was known as a reformist, he didn't give the morality police as much power as for example Rouhani, again a so-called reformist. It was similar to this period where it existed, but it wasn't as vigorous, the morality police on the underground. But the coming to power of Ibrahim Raisi, the current president of Iran, who's the present supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and the Ayatollah and the leading religious class have observed an erosion of what they class as Islamic values in Iran, especially the hijab, more women not observing the chador, the black veil, or wearing the hijab inappropriate. So they've kind of expanded the powers of the morality police, and the police, and this police force is composed of official personnel, but also unofficial, i.e. they have a paramilitary force known as the Basij, which it recruits from university campuses, and they have offices across university campuses across Iran. So this force is also part of the morality police, and so anything they see as being immoral, they will clamp down on. So there's been a witch hunt against women in Iran who've not been observing the hijab. So they've been arrested, detained, and there's been many other instances of torture and beatings, but never did someone die. This is the reason as to why this incident has really, of Mahsa Amini's killing, has really kicked off or sparked protests across Iran. Right, the second part of the question in terms of the regime is quite strange in terms of the system. The system, it's a dual system. So on one side, you have a system that's maybe conventionally known to the listeners. You have a president, you have a cabinet, a government, and you have a parliament, and you have elections for the parliament, and you have elections, the provincial authority, and so on. So you have that system that kind of replicates many other systems around the world. But then you have on the other side, you have a kind of a vetting system or blocking system that kind of keeps a check over the first system that I just mentioned. So you have the Guardian Council, which is comprised of 12 people, 6 jurists, 6 clerics, who are appointed by the supreme leader. And the job of the Guardian Council, in effect, is to block legislation, vet legislation, is to vet candidates for the elections as well, and to maybe give advice on bills and ratification of law and so on and so forth, right? So you have that body. Then you also have the Assembly of Experts. The Assembly of Experts is composed of 88 people who are elected by direct elections, but obviously each candidate for that body has to be vetted by the Guardian Council. So the Assembly of Experts, his role in principle is to appoint the next supreme leader, right? And to discuss who the next supreme leader will be, and to account the supreme leader, and to remove him if he transgresses the tenets that are set out in the Iranian constitution, right? So you have these two bodies, then you have the IRGC, which is a paramilitary force, which runs parallel to the Iranian army and the Iranian navy and so on. And then you have the Quds force, which is again a paramilitary force which exists in the region, in Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and these countries. Then you have the Basij force, which is another paramilitary force, which is more internal security. So you have this kind of dual system. On the one hand, you have the formal system, then you have the informal system, and they've been working in tandem since the revolution. But post-revolution, this system didn't just there was no blueprint, right? It kind of developed over a period of time, and the dual side, either the Guardian Council came into being, then Assembly of Experts came into being, and the IRGC then was developed and expanded in its role and capacity and so on and so forth. So that's the kind of internal dynamics of the Iranian political system. So it's quite strange. You don't have anything of that nature in the world today, where you have this two systems coexisting and working together over a period of 40 years.
How would you describe the relationship between the Iranian people and the regime?
Obviously the Iranian regime has its support base, especially within rural areas, which are a backbone in terms of support for the Iranian regime. But then you have in the urban areas, the cities, you have a bit of a mixed bunch. You have the middle class who are being crunched economically because of the economic crisis. So that's led to a lot of discontentment towards the regime. Even in the middle class, you have the conservative and the religious factions who are upset with the regime because of what's happening. You have the Bazaaris, which have traditionally been loyal to the regime because of economic benefits and patronage, etc. But they're upset as well with the regime now because of the economic situation. Then you have the younger generation born at the time of the Iranian Revolution. Did they experience that atmosphere? Did they experience the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s? So they're completely detached from the revolution, and they're basically fed up with the regime because of lack of opportunities, no jobs, poor education, socioeconomic deterioration, and no future, basically. They don't see any hope, they don't see any future, and they see a lot of hypocrisy in terms of the regime and its behavior, right? So you have that, all of these kind of elements. But also then, if you look at the Kurdistan province, the Kurdish people, they've been mistreated by the regime, so there's no love there between the regime and the Kurdish element. Then in the north, you have the East Azerbaijan, you have the West Azerbaijan provinces, you have Zanjan province, you have the Erbil provinces. These are all Azeri Turks. So Azeri Turks number maybe 15 million out of 85 million people in Iran. And there's a lot of Azeri nationalism, especially in the aftermath of the Azerbaijan and the Armenian war. So that's kind of stirred separatist sentiments amongst the Azeri people. Then you have on the eastern flank that kind of borders the Arabian Gulf, you have the Khuzestan province, which is basically Ahwaz, which is Arab. And the Iranians basically changed the name from Ahwaz, which was always known as Ahwaz, to Khuzestan, and gave it a Persian identity, a Persian name, and so on. So the Arabs there don't really like the Iranian regime, because they've siphoned off the oil and the resources there and left a huge mess in terms of poverty and unemployment within the region. Then against on the east side, bordering Afghanistan or Pakistan, you have the Sistan Baluchistan province. Again, Sunnis there, and they have no love with the regime because of oppression and mistreatment and economic neglect. So you have a regime in power in Tehran, but they have a huge amount of problems with the native population in terms of the Iranians, Persian Iranians, and then the other minorities that exist there. There's problems, so there's heavy military deployment in those areas to keep them under control. So you have a very fragile situation now for the regime, and this is the reason as to why the regime has been very eager to enforce the ideas of the revolution and to bring hardliners into power in terms of the parliament and the presidential office and so on, to make sure the revolution survives. Because because Khamenei, he's in his 80s now, and he's in his ill, so he doesn't want to leave a situation where the revolution is at risk. The revolution comes caving down, right? So he's kind of boring hardliners into power, and their job is basically to make sure the regime survives and the revolution survives into the future.
The image you get from Iran is there was an Islamic revolution, and the legitimacy of the regime is in its Islamic character. So I suppose my question is, how Islamic is the regime, and how different is it to some of the other local regimes? Obviously, you've got Saudi Arabia, who claims some Islamic legitimacy. You've got Turkey that claims it. So how Islamic is the regime, and how is it any different to the other regimes in the region that also claim Islamic legitimacy?
The regime, it has the name of Islam and name of religion. And it says it represents the Shia faith and the Jafri fiqh and so on, and the leader, supreme leader, claims kind of legitimacy from being the representative of the Mahdi and so on. So they have that. For example, they teach in the schooling system Islam and about Shia faith and Shia history and so on and so forth, and they'll have certain Islamic punishments. And they have the morality police. They'll ban Western music, Western culture, and Western movies, and so on and so forth. But the problem is that the regime itself is highly corrupt. The regime is corrupt. There's a mismanagement of the economy. When the people look at the regime and see hypocrisy, they're told to live an austere life, meaning to live within the means. Then they see the regime and its officials and their families and children living a very affluent lifestyle. So they're told to wear the hijab, but the daughters of the elite of the regime don't wear the hijab. So there's videos of them, you know, going to Switzerland or to going to Los Angeles, and they're not wearing the hijab, they're not covering, and so on, right? So they see a lot of hypocrisy for the government, the regime, and officials, right? And this has led to a lot of tensions between the people and the regime. So it's not the case that the people in Iran don't like Islam or don't love Islam and don't want to be Shia, right, and to follow Shia law, etc. But the point is that when they're looking at those who are representing them and those who are supposed to be implementing that law on them, they don't see a consistency, they see a hypocrisy, right? So this is the reason as to why you see a lot of rebellion against the state and the symbols and what it represents, as we see now with the hijab. For example, when Mahsa Amini was just killed recently, there was a lot of pressure upon Western governments to condemn the Iranian regime and to take some action, right? So Britain condemned the killing, but apart from that, it's not really sanctioned Iran or sanctioned individuals, right? And there's a video that was going around where you had kids of senior Iranian officials in London at the time of the killing of Mahsa Amini, and they're partying away in London in a very fancy hotel, and they're partying away. So when people in Iran see all this, they're living a very miserable life, no opportunity, no hope. Then they see the kids of these officials living a very affluent life, traveling around the world, driving nice cars, nice wearing nice clothing, right? This, the resentment and the anger grows towards the representation, or what the regime is representing, because the regime came into power on the back of Islam and represented Islam and established an Islamic Republic. But they don't see any consistency in terms of behavior from the regime and their families and their children and so on and so forth in terms of their representation of Islam and then discharging their responsibility, right? So you see a loggerhead conflict between the two right now, and it's peaking because of the protests.
Mohammed, the regime paints a picture that America's to blame for everything, for the sanctions and for all the problems Iran is facing. So 2 points, really. What has the impact of sanctions been on the Iranian economy, or on people's daily lives? And do the people see it the way the regime is putting it, that America is the cause of all of Iran's problems?
Well, this is the narrative of the Iranian regime post-revolution. It's all our problems are because of the Americans or the Zionists. And there's no doubt there's an element of truth to that, right? Israel has been involved in assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists and sabotage Iranian nuclear plants. This is well documented. Everyone knows this. America is the one that's imposed sanctions on Iran since the 1979 Iranian revolution, right? They see that, and the impact has been quite dire, and has led to a lot of suffering in Iran. So you just need to look at stats and graphs and so on. Just for example, pre-GCPOA, the Iranian nuclear deal that was signed in 2015, there was a decline in GDP, there was a decline in import-export with the world. But once the agreement was signed, you see the upsurge in GDP, upsurge in trade with the world. But when Trump withdrew in May 2018, again, there's a dip. There's a big dip in these indicators that I've mentioned. So sanctions have had an impact, right? But at the same time, the Iranian regime has been wasting a lot of funds, a lot of money on its foreign policy adventures in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, and so on, funding militias and proxies across the whole region, right? So the Iranian people are saying, wait a minute, right, okay, we understand the sanction, the impact of sanctions, but you're wasting a lot of resources, right? So you see a lot of protests over the last couple of years where protests are saying, look, Yemen is not in our name, Syria's not in our name, Iraq's not in our name. Stop funding these proxies and these militias around the world and invest in Iran, invest in development, invest in job creation and so on, right? So people are not buying that is 100% fault of the Americans or in terms of the sanctions. They're saying, look, at the same time, there's mismanagement, there's corruption in Iran that could be better handled, but you don't see any severe action on these fronts, even though Raisi, the present president, when he came to power, he said, look, in his promises that I'm going to crack down hard on corruption and those involved in corruption, but he's not really done much. So you see this kind of inconsistency in their statements, and the Iranian people are fully aware and conscious of what the leader does and he doesn't do, what the government does. So they do blame the sanctions. Obviously, the sanctions are to blame to a part, to a great extent, of what's happening, but the government's mismanagement is not a fault of any other one than themselves, right? So this is the kind of situation that we are at the moment.
The clerical system has managed to survive for over four decades. How have they been able to do that? And do you see this continuing for the foreseeable future?
There's no sign that the system is going to collapse. Even Khamenei, after the death of Mahsa Amini, said this is not about the hijab, this is about the system. So he's fully aware that, look, there's a campaign internally to bring down the system. And if you look at a lot of the slogans, they'd be very direct and very explicit against Khamenei, against the regime, against Walid al-Fakir, the system, and so on, right? So this is unprecedented. You've never seen this before. Okay, you've seen it over the last few years, but it's increasing into the momentum. And if you look at the map of protests over the last 4 years, they've spread throughout the whole of Iran. So you've seen protests going on for social issues, economic issues, foreign policy issues for the last 4 or 5 years and non-stop. So this is something that's scary for the regime in Tehran, right? And this is the reason as to why Khamenei, he wanted to make sure that in the last parliamentary elections that his people won and Ibrahim Raisi became the president, so that they can really reinforce the values of the revolution and and ensure that the legitimacy of the regime doesn't erode any further, right, to kind of stabilize the regime. Because what you have to remember, Iran is at a very delicate point in time because there's a succession crisis now, or a succession debate now. Who will succeed Khamenei? He's in his 80s, maybe 88, I think, and he's ill. This discussion about the current president becoming the next supreme leader, there's a discussion about Mujtaba al-Khamenei, who's the son of the present supreme leader, becoming the next supreme leader. And there's evidence that points towards this because Mujtaba Khamenei was elevated to Ayatollah level. So you cannot become a supreme leader unless you're Ayatollah, which is the highest rank, clerical rank that you have within within the Shia school. So this kind of plans in place for him to succeed or Ibrahim Raisi to succeed and so on, right? So whilst they're making all these plans, they're facing all these challenges now, internal challenges from their own population, which is against the system, right? And they were transition. So, for example, there's been various polls that have been done, and a recent one that was done by an institute in Netherlands called Gamam, and it mentioned that over 60% of the population was a transition from the existing system to a new system, right? Although there's a debate regarding polls and validity of polls, but this and many other polls indicate that, look, people are not very happy and so on. But you'd need a mass uprising, a non-stop uprising involving all sectors of society for the regime to actually collapse with external support, right? But the external powers at the moment, like America, are not really interested in bringing down the regime because they have an issue of Ukraine. They want to sign a nuclear deal that was ended by Trump in 2018. So they don't have much interest in causing another political crisis within the key country within the Middle East at this moment in time. So without a mass-scale uprising involving all sectors of society, secular, liberal, leftist, conservative, with external support, you're unlikely to see a collapse of the regime. The regime is going to just use brute force, brutality, to deal with the protesters and see another day. And that's what they've done for the last 40 years.
You've probably answered my final question. If these protests are to succeed, what needs to happen? So I suppose, Mohammed, could the opposition or the public not by themselves be able to overthrow the regime? Do they necessarily need external support?
The opposition forces, like the reformists and the modernists, in fact, are another face of the regime. They have certain disagreements upon certain social issues, like, for example, the wearing of the hijab or the chador, and public freedom, etc. Right? But they all believe in the system. They believe in the Wilayat al-Faqih system. They believe in the supreme leader. So, like, for example, in 2009 presidential elections, when Ahmadinejad won a second term, the leader of those protests, which is the Green Movement that started, Mir Hossein Mousavi, right? He was allowed to stand as a presidential candidate by the Guardian Council, so he could not have been against the system or the regime. In principle, otherwise he would never have been allowed to stand, right? So you have, even though he's in the house arrest, these candidates who exist and they may class themselves as reformists or modernists in opposition to the hardliners, they all believe in the system and they all believe in the regime, right? So the opposition themselves are not going to bring down the system. Now, the population, it needs a mass mobilization, as we saw in the Arab Spring, to bring down the regime, right? Unless that mass mobilization is there, you're likely to see massive overturn in terms of a weakening of the regime. Yes, legitimacy will decline, but in terms of existence and its presence, it's unlikely to be affected unless there's, as you mentioned, is a mass uprising, as we saw during the revolution, Iranian Revolution 1979, when the mass revolution with external help, with a figurehead such as charismatic figure such as Khomeini, who galvanized the rich, the poor, the leftist, the liberal, the secularist, and they all were under his bandwagon for their own interest. But that was enough to remove the Pahlavi regime, the Reza Shah, right? Unless something on that level happens, these protests will continue for another week or two, right? But then they'll be killed off by brute force and brute oppressive means by the regime. And it seems that the regime is trying to apologize now. Look, this was a rogue police officer that did this, and they want an investigation. So it seems that they want to calm the situation down because they don't want it to escalate any further than it has already, right? So the regime will kind of use its means to kind of water down the situation and survive another day. And that's what it's done for the last 40 years. But in terms of a removal of the regime, it's very unlikely.
Okay, thank you for your time today, Mohammed. That was a great insight.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
If you want to learn more about the issues raised today, please check our website, www.thegeopolity.com, all one word. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Adnan, and thank you for listening.